Hello, friends, and welcome back to the second hour of Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in the Seattle area on the west coast of the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place, and I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better place. During this second hour from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Seattle time today, I'll be interviewing my good friend Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian Minister of Defense, who was their minister during the 1960s and who personally knew President Kennedy. I really like Paul, and he'll be coming on in just a few minutes. Then tomorrow, on Saturday, December 1st, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., I have a Christmas present for everyone here in the area. I'll be having a free psychic and healing fair in Olympia. The fair will be held at 9101 Stillicum Road, southeast in Olympia, and it's free. It's off of just drive down there and go to exit either 111 or 114. It's about 5 minutes off those exits. If you need directions, feel free to send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, or you can call me at 509-750-9793. It's going to be a fun Christmas party for everyone. I'll have cookies and candles and coffees and whatnot, eggnog for everybody, and it's a Christmas present to everyone who supported my show. At 11 a.m. tomorrow, during the fair, I'll be giving a free presentation on healing with scalar energy. Now, scalar energy, you may wonder, what is scalar energy? Well, I have a wonderful lady who was cured healed by Tom's scalar program, and she'll be coming on in just a minute. Other techniques from the Hollow Earth we'll be giving for healing. And then at 12 noon tomorrow, I'll be giving a free updated lecture on my new book that was published last year called Messages from the Masters, with new updates from Albert Einstein, President Kennedy, Nostradamus, and others on some really wonderful things happening right near on the planet. And with that, let's bring on Anui Nui. She was healed by Tom's program, and I'd like to talk about with her just for a few minutes on what happened. Anui Nui, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Hi there. I'm so glad you could come on today.
Now, thank you for having me.
Yeah. You don't have to discuss the details of how Tom's scalar program worked, unless you want to, but how did Tom's scalar program work? And I want to tell everybody it's a free program, so all you do is send your picture into them, and he does healing work on you using his technology from home in Florida. But go ahead, if you can, just go ahead and share what you like about that.
Yes, it was. I actually met him at your conference, and that was probably one of the best things I could have ever encountered was Tom Palladino and listening to his technology on scalar energy and how he's able to dismantle pathogens, viruses, bacteria, fungus. And as he was talking, I understood, for some reason, as he was talking, I understood everything he was saying about how through energy he's able to heal. Myself as being an intuitive and growing in a family of healers, energy healers, it was like, wow, now there's someone who can actually cure not just one person at a time, but millions of people at a time. And so he was offering this 15-day scalar energy treatment, and it was complimentary. And so I went home and followed the directions, signed up, and just basically submitted a photo.
Okay.
And you don't have to submit a photo of your face. A hand will do, a leg will do, a back, anything, as long as there's skin. I didn't have to say anything about what I had. But I had a tumor in my mouth that was caused by the HPV virus.
Okay.
Very similar to, there's various HPV viruses.
Is it?
But it was very similar to the warts that you get on your hands.
Is it similar to herpes, for example? Or
it's not herpes per se, but Tom's scalar energy can dismantle the herpes virus.
Okay.
Many people have... it's been very successful, actually curing herpes 1 and 2.
Amazing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it also works with animals. With my picture, I sent a picture with me and my key cat.
Okay.
And she had a lesion that was healing very slowly, and that healed really quickly.
Wow, amazing.
But with Tom's Healer Energy, it was seamless. He does it remotely.
Yeah.
From Florida. I didn't feel anything other than actually a rejuvenation of the area of my mouth where the tumor was.
Mm-hmm.
I started feeling tingling sensation. So I understood that it was actually revitalizing the nerve.
Wow.
That at one time when I had the tumor, because I don't have the tumor anymore, it was numbed. Or maybe paralyzed the nerve cells.
Wow.
So yeah, it took. So I did the treatment for the free, complimentary 15 days,
right.
And then it took 91 days for it to completely disappear.
Wow, that's amazing. I want to give out the site where you send in your photograph if you wish to try this for free, 15 days.
Mm-hmm.
It's www.self, S-E-L-F, heal, H-E-A-L, go.com. And you click on the free trials, or you can go www.selfhealgo.com/free-trials, and end of /. So anyway, Anui, thank you so much for sharing this. I've got to go on to my next guest now.
Well, thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you coming on, because your testimony to how it can help people, and nothing better than the truth.
Yes, and for the audience, you can go on to Tom's website in the articles part. Mm-hmm. I share my story with photographs that I took every single day.
Amazing.
You can go and check that out.
That's great. That's great.
Well, thank you, Ted.
Okay, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. Okay.
You're welcome.
Hey, bye-bye. Bye. That was Nui. She had tremendous success. There were other testimonies as well on Tom's website, so feel free to check that out. And again, tomorrow I'll be giving a lecture on it and giving information out at 11 a.m. tomorrow about Tom's wonderful program. Well, with that, I'd like to bring on my good friend, Paul Hellier. Paul, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Paul. It's good to talk to you.
Likewise. Good to hear you.
Oh, it's good to talk to you. Well, just a short blurb about your background. I consider you one of Canada's best known and honest politicians. And one thing I like about you, Paul, you always speak with your heart. And I really liked your book, Hope Restored. I read it, and I got lots of questions. You also come out in favor of UFO disclosure. And I really like your work, and I'm so happy you could come on my show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Wonderful. The first part of the book is on your political career, and the second part is on what things we can do to make this world a better place. And I have to ask you before we start, thanks for sharing the details of your political career. And I wanted to ask you, you had a little story in there about you almost missed your plane out of Moscow, Russia in 1977 going back to Canada. And at the time, the relations between Canada and Russia, the Soviets, were not that good. There was some sort of
Restrained.
Restrained, yeah.
Because we had asked some of their diplomats to leave our country. And this was not looked on with favor in Moscow.
Sure.
And so they gave me the pleasure of sitting in the VIP lounge until the plane was ready to take off. And when I say ready, I think I put in the book there that I ran as fast as I could.
Right.
And went through the gate, and it slammed right behind me.
Do you think, what airline was that? Was that Air Canada or?
No, that was Aeroflot.
Aeroflot. Oh, real Aeroflot. Okay. Do you think the Russians would have kept you there if you'd missed your flight?
That's a question I can't answer. They certainly kept me there as long as they possibly could.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, one more, you know, light question to ask you before we go on to lots of other good questions. You said that they fed you steak, but then you realized it wasn't exactly beef steak. What kind of steak was it, by the way? Chicken or?
It was horse steak.
Horse steak. Wow. Yeah. Did it taste like chicken or?
No, it tasted like horse steak.
All right.
Any questions?
No, just curious. They say everything tastes like chicken, but...
Yeah. But no, it's it looks like beefsteak.
Well.
But it's coarse.
Wow.
And it's hard to chew and so on. But
well,
for them, they didn't get much meat.
Sure.
And for them, it was a treat.
Oh, yeah.
And all the guests there who were from Russia were delighted to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who were used to Canadian beef, especially Western beef,
sure,
were disappointed, if I could sort of make an understatement.
Yeah. Well, they were giving you a treat from their cultural perspective, which they thought was great.
Absolutely. They were doing what they thought was good.
And that was good. You know, that was good. But it was kind of a light moment there in your book. Well, I wanted to, I read in chapter 17 about your spiritual journey in a little sentence here to lead this off. From the time I, Paul, made a decision to surrender the direction of my life to God in 1957, I witnessed a series of miracles. And then you talked about creating with the communication with the Creator telepathically, and that really caught my eye because this is, after all, a spiritual program we're out of this world here. So for you to talk about spirituality in that context was really really great. In your book, you mentioned you witnessed a series of miracles after you started communicating with the Creator.
Well, yes. When I say miracles, there are things that would normally you wouldn't expect to happen.
Right.
One of them was either was out of the House of Commons at the time because I'd been defeated in the previous election.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back to my business and thought, well, that's it for now and maybe forever.
Sure.
And within days of having made that decision, the newly elected MP and the next riding, which you would call district, was watching the World Series, a baseball game, and dropped dead.
Oh, no.
And he never did sit in the house.
Hmm.
And, of course, one of my really good friends at the time phoned me and said, have you heard the news? And then explained what had happened. And it was really not very polite to talk about for a chap when he was not yet on the ground.
Sure.
But my friend was saying, this is going to be an opening for you. And that's the way it turned out. And the odds of that happening are what, 1 million or something like that?
Sure.
And so I got back in the house and led the way. And at the time of that by-election in 58, the odds, the Gallup poll showed that the government party had 60% of the support of the country,
mm-hmm.
and we the liberals only had 30.
Oh, wow.
So it was 2-1,
uh-huh.
Still won.
Wow, amazing.
So, you know, there are some things going on there. There was a lot of help.
Wow.
And what happened was that the government supporters didn't vote. They just stayed home because they already had all of the other members in the city,
uh-huh.
and they didn't need one more.
Uh-huh.
I had campaigned on the idea that they needed one person at least in the opposition down there to try and keep the others honest.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, Paul, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you went back into politics. And
well, I think it was all planned because if I had not gotten back then,
right,
I would never have been Minister of Defense.
Okay, sure.
It was the fact that I got back and became what we call the shadow government, shadow of the Minister of mm-hmm. Defense. And even though when the Pearson government was formed, I was not the logical one, probably, in the eyes of many, that there was a brigadier general who had fought in the war and so on who
sure.
was considered more qualified. But I got the job. And the rest of it, as they say, is history.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you got the defense, to become the Prime Minister of Defense during that time, because you were there at a critical time when the United States was, for example, going into Vietnam. President Kennedy, just before he was assassinated, actually issued an order to start withdrawing troops, from what I understand, Paul from Vietnam. And on the top of page 195 in your book, Hope Restored, you write that in your meetings with the U.S. Secretary of Defense McNamara, he was always trying to persuade you that Canada should join the United States in Vietnam.
Correct, yes.
And I think that would have been a monumental mistake for Canada. I think it was a mistake for the United States, of course, to go into Vietnam, too.
That's what I thought, too.
Yeah. And I want to thank you for remaining steadfast during that time, at a time when I'm sure you, Canada, received a lot of pressure to go in to Vietnam.
Well, the U.S. really wanted us to go in, but I think it was more tokenism, you know, to try and spread the blame or whatever.
Right.
And it didn't make any sense. And I kept telling Bob McNamara that you couldn't win a jungle war by blowing the tops off the trees.
Really?
And
amazing.
Ultimately, they came to that realization, and unfortunately, much too late to save a lot of lives.
Sure, sure. I remember during that time, during the Vietnam War, too, I had relatives in Sweden, and they were all against the war. And their take on it was different from mine, because they received much different information than what I was getting in the U.S. Mass media. Even today, stuff is highly filtered here, as you know, and things...
very, very highly, as you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've had... I mean, there's quite a bit we could go on, but you had one chapter in your book about the story of Reuters, R-E-U-T-E-R-S, who... you thought was a reputable organization. Then you realized that the chairman of the Reuters media outfit in the United States here was actually a Bilderberger, and they very tightly controlled what was fed to the American public.
Well, they said in effect to the people that I call the cabal, and some others call it the cabal too. That
sure,
whatever they came up with, Reuters, but or whatever you want to call it, would make sure it was published. Mm-hmm. So this is controlled news, and it's just the kind of thing that I personally do not approve of, because I think news is supposed to be straight goods without bias. But obviously, there are very few cases in which it is.
You mentioned a quote, too. I'm looking for it now, that that David Rockefeller, the late David Rockefeller, congratulated the New York Times, the Washington Post, and also other media outlets here in the United States for their cooperation in basically editing and twisting the news so that this cabal would be able to pursue their agenda of taking over the United States.
Yeah, what I think it was doing was just saying that they were filtering the news so that the things that were being done,
right,
the most important things that were being done, just mm-hmm. never came to the public attention.
Sure, sure.
And this is a, you know, it's a terrible revelation, really.
Right.
That the presumably the most prestigious news outlets in the United States,
right,
were filtering the news and only putting out what we call the elite masters, as they became,
right,
wanted and what they planned to do. And this is a great disappointment mm-hmm. in what you know purports to be a free and independent country.
Sure, sure.
And you find out it isn't free, and there are subjects that just will not find their way into the newspapers. And I'm very concerned about that, because I'm not sure how we can get the truth out to the American people, the extent to which they have been taken over by the military,
right,
in right. time to save the military from establishing the new world order that they've been talking about, and probably getting into population reduction and all the things that horrific things that sort of go with it.
I want to mention, Paul, I don't mean to interrupt my friend, but last night I was doing some research on the California fires. During my first hour, I had a segment on the California fires, and the latest death toll from those fires in Paradise, California alone is 30,000 people. Now the California Director of Emergency Management says only 66 people killed in the state as a result of the fires, which I think is grossly inaccurate. But it goes back. There's almost nothing about what's really happening with those fires now and what really happened. They were apparently directed energy weapons that fried a lot of people right in their homes. And the thing is, you look at these pictures, Paul, and you see this rubble of the house and the trees right next to it, gardens, flowers. But the cars are melted and the homes are completely destroyed, and there's woods around it. I've got that quote from David Rockefeller. You quoted this in your book. David Rockefeller said, quote, "We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, etc., whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for all of 40 years. This must have been back in the 90s or around maybe 10 years ago. He writes, "It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the lights of publicity during those years." That's one of the reasons why I had a program on the California fires last week and also during this last hour, because it's being totally ignored by the media in this country. But then you go back and you also have a section on the cabal, chapter 18, which you define as a large and amorphous body that cannot be defined with precision.
Yeah, the cabal is really running the United States, has been for years,
uh-huh.
and wants to run the world.
Right.
And that's the aim of the game. And really, Rockefeller made no, he didn't try to avoid that being the aim of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I quoted him is because he has in his memoirs that that's what was up, and that he was proud of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's no doubt that he was, one of my friends called him, a webmaster
mm-hmm.
for the financials community and so on, largely starting after World War II,
sure.
doing some of the dirty work or a lot of the dirty work for mm-hmm. the even richer people who were involved in the banking cartel. I don't know if your listeners realize how much concentration of wealth there has been. In about 4 years ago, roughly, four or five,
right.
82 families controlled 50% of all the wealth in the world. And next year it was, 80 families. And the following year it dropped to 62 families.
Wow.
So now 62 families control half of the wealth in the whole world, and I cannot get my head around this. And I was explaining on another program that you start taking the big cities, and you can start in Asia with Peking and Tokyo and the huge Chinese cities and so on, and come across with San Francisco and Los Angeles and Vancouver, and then on to the eastern cities, the industrial cities, and New York and Montreal and Toronto
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
up the pond and get to Manchester and London and so on, and on to France and Paris and on around the world. And what you really are seeing is that the 62 families own every second city in the whole world.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So going up and down the West Coast here, let's say the families own Seattle. And then you go down to Portland. They don't own Portland, but then you go up to Vancouver, and they own Vancouver. And it's just mind-boggling to think about that. Wow!
It is so mind-boggling. It is very difficult to get through your head. At least maybe, I don't know. Maybe you can do it more easily than I can. But
well,
for me, I say this is just so sure. outrageous, really.
Yeah.
That it makes you makes you wonder how the world has been run,
right?
And where we're going from here.
Sure, sure.
Because all of that concentration of power,
right,
is aimed at, in effect, taking over the world.
Right, Exactly.
And they're doing a fairly good job of it. Well, they're doing an exceedingly good job.
Oh, yeah, right.
So there are actions that have to be taken to stop it before it's too late.
Right. Right.
That's the problem, and the monetary system is one of them.
Right.
I have this, as you know, in my last two books in particular.
Right.
The Money Mafia.
Right.
The World in Crisis.
Right.
Sets out very clearly how the monetary system works.
Right.
How, in effect, these few people create money out of thin air.
Thin air, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's all the debt. They lend it to us.
Right.
And we have to pay back both principal and interest, even though the money to do that does not exist.
You know, our Federal Reserve here in the United States, forgive me interrupting, Paul, is such a scam. They're not federal. They're not reserve. In violation of Article 7 of the United States Constitution, in which the Treasury Department is supposed to be the only legal agency to issue our money, you have 13 private banks of the so-called Federal Reserve issuing our currency here in the United States. It's not federal. It's not reserve. And they charge us taxpayers for them to issue our currency in violation of
sure,
that.
The American people own the right.
Right.
But they gave it away to the richest, most powerful bankers in the world a little over 100 years ago.
That's right.
I call it the biggest heist in history.
Yep. Yep.
And there will be no solution to many of the problems until you take it back.
Right.
So
right.
It has to be nationalized.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to start producing some government-issued money.
Right.
So
right.
That it's not all debt. And, you know, I've been promoting 34%.
Right.
And if we achieve that over a period of 7 years, 34% cash reserves in the banking system, that would not only allow us to balance the budget federally, state-wise, and in the municipalities,
wow,
and have enough left over to start paying down a little bit of the national debt.
Sure.
And that has to happen, but nobody's talking about it.
Right.
And, of course, that's where the censorship in the press comes in, because one of the friends down there who is a financial genius said that after the Fed was established, that the Morgan Bank and some others got together and had a group pick out the 25 most powerful newspapers in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And to, in effect, buy either the papers or their editorial control of the most powerful 25 papers,
mm-hmm,
so that the American people would never really be exposed to the truth of what was going on, that they were being robbed.
Amazing. Amazing. And
so
it was
Ellen Brown. Ellen Hodgson Brown.
Ellen Brown. Okay.
Yeah, and she wrote an excellent, a wonderful book, what's the name of it? The Web of Debt.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to read the whole book. You read the first 100 pages, it'll give your hair will stand on its end, and if you have any, I haven't.
Wow.
Not much, anyway.
Okay.
And then you'll know just how they operate.
Sure. Right. Right. Well, we can discuss. This is an alternative a media here station with a large worldwide following, and we can discuss these issues here. These things you're not going to hear on CNN or the other ABC, CBS, whatever, the alphabet soup media outlets. They just don't talk about it. And, you know, the sad thing is, I got a report, I think I mentioned that last night, that there were like 30,000 people who died in the Paradise, California fire, one of the biggest disasters in American history, and it's not being talked at all by the media. Nothing. Zip. Nada. Zilch. Nothing. Not a thing. So you kind of wonder what's wrong with these people. Something like that they just ignore. And I kind of wonder how many people would have to die in a tragic tragedy like that for them to report on. Half a million, a million? If 10 million people died, do you think the mass media in the United States might give it a small story on the back pages, on page 50 of the New York Times? I don't know. It's hard to, I don't know what their threshold is. But you talked about the post-World War II history, and you've been, of course, a very big proponent of UFO disclosure. And you talked about 1954, Eisenhower's meeting benevolent ETs, which he turned down after their offer of help. And then in 1957, President Eisenhower then again turned down the help of Valiant Thor, benevolent extraterrestrial, for his help. Do you think... Well, I wish they'd come back and offer us their help again today, Paul, because we really need it.
I think they... Frankly, I think they would like to.
Right.
But... That is what the cabal will do their utmost best to make sure doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Because my whole thrust there, as you know, is that war is obsolete.
Right.
And we shouldn't be spending all of this money for armaments.
Right.
And, of course, when the attack on Pearl Harbor came, and I think most Americans now know that it was a fake,
right.
The defense expenditures were increased 100%.
Sure, right.
Even though there was no enemy.
Right.
The whole thing was designed to funnel American taxpayers' money.
Right.
Into the military.
Right.
And it's still going on, and the amount is increasing. But who's the enemy?
Right.
And why do you need to build up a space capability when we don't need it? The Galactic Federation would be glad to protect us.
Sure.
But we're, I think, in building an ionized space fence, which is going on at the present. Well, I think maybe it's finished now.
Hmm.
Want to keep them out so they can't come to our rescue.
Well, what's ironic about that is that because of the illegal treaty that President Eisenhower negotiated with the reptilians and the Greys, especially the reptilians, back in March of 54, that in exchange for some of their technology to fight the Soviets, President Eisenhower let the reptilians abduct humans and take them off planet, and they've negatively influenced, I think, our civilization ever since then. So if we build space-based defense, sealing off this planet from other civilizations, we're going to be sealing off the negative entities from coming in, and yet keeping in these keep sealing off the positive entities from coming in, and sealing in these negative entities, who want us to destroy ourselves.
It's a very tense situation,
mm-hmm.
as I develop later in the book, as you know.
Sure.
And it's going to take the millions of Americans to make demands on the president and the Congress,
right,
to grant an amnesty to the people who have been involved in the black budget,
right,
and let them tell the truth,
right,
and to stop developing some of these things. I just had a piece of paper on my desk here, losing humanity. Technological advances and weaponry are far outpacing international law.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on to say that they're developing both machines and robots to kill on order. And there's no law governing this sort of thing.
Well, I think we saw that in the California fires last week in both Paradise and Malibu, California, where you had thousands of the people who were killed by directed energy weapons, laser beams. And they were fired from satellites and planes, and we have no control over that. So.
Well, I'm not an expert in that. I don't know,
yeah.
Ted.
I would
take your word for it, but
yeah.
I know that they have that capability.
Sure, sure.
And the capability is so frightening, really.
Right.
That something has to be done about it very soon, and that's the reason that I wrote Hope Restored,
mm-hmm.
is to try and get people's interest in taking back control of their country.
Thank you.
Before it's too late.
Thank you.
And there are things that have to be done and can be done, but if they're not done,
sure,
then there is no hope.
Sure, sure.
And it's about as simple as that. So,
well, writing your book, getting the information out there, doing the shows on my show too, and many other wonderful media, alternative media outlets. I think we're all making a difference. I wanted to mention something important. I mean, there's a lot of really good points that you make in your book. But you wrote that in 1974, Wernher von Braun, who was a Nazi scientist we recruited after World War II, announced through his assistant, Carol Rosen, that because the U.S. did not have enemies to justify their huge military expenditures, the U.S. military complex would have to first create enemies to justify any kind of military spending. Wernher von Braun is very interesting. He said the first enemies would be the communists, then the terrorists, and then the extraterrestrials. And you kind of see that script playing out since World War II. First, it was
following the script, isn't it?
Yeah, following the script. First, it was the communist, and then when they went by the wayside, then we had the terrorists.
But you had to manufacture the terrorists. There weren't enough until the Iraq War was started.
Yeah, absolutely right.
After 9/11.
Right.
And I was mentioning we Canadians had a couple of. Our diplomats taken hostage in northern Africa.
Uh-huh.
And after they had been there for a long time, one of the chief person looking after them, making sure they didn't escape and so on, our guy, and I actually know him personally, said to him, when did you become a radical?
Mm-hmm.
He said, I was a moderate. I became a radical as soon as the American bombs started dropping on Baghdad.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we went from having a handful of terrorists,
right,
which could be easily handled by police and intelligence organizations, to creating tens of thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just multiplying like mushrooms because
right.
of the drones and the other things that have been used against the people. And it keeps putting gas on the fire, really.
Right. I don't know too much about this war. I hear a little bits of it here and there on the internet, Paul, about the war in Yemen. There have been allegations that behind the back door, the U.S. military complex is funding a war there as well. I don't know too much about it, though. But again, there's
I think what they're probably doing is providing a lot of the machines and the ammunition to the Saudis.
Right.
And the Saudis are really, what they're doing there is absolutely inhumane.
Right.
And it should not be allowed.
Right.
But nobody's doing anything because of their close connection. They have very close connections with the United States and England.
Oh, they do. Okay.
And consequently, they're allowed to do things that most other countries wouldn't be allowed to do.
Right.
But again, I guess it goes back to oil money, I guess, but the fact that they had more of it than most people.
Right, exactly. Well, one of the things that you mentioned in your book was that the military-industrial complex needed an event of like Pearl Harbor back in the late 90s, early part of this century, to trigger more military spending. And they got that event with 9/11. And you wrote, you cited the book, Where Did the Towers Go? And you said that the buildings in 9/11 in New York City were exploded with controlled demolition. I agree with you. I think it was a complete fabricated false flag. I'll never forget the broadcast by the British British Broadcasting by the BBC in New York when they were right in front of Building 7. Now that was you had the Twin Towers and there was a third building that also collapsed, but the BBC reporter was standing in front of this tower of this Building 7 in New York City, Paul, and she was explaining how the building had collapsed. The only problem was that from one of the terrorist planes flying into it. The only problem, Paul, is that the building was still standing behind her. And then there was no building, there was no plane that went into it, and then suddenly it collapsed. So the story was, she was obviously fed a script to read on the air, and she did that for the BBC. But it didn't match up with what really happened in the building.
That's amazing. But as you probably know, there were five buildings that collapsed.
Ah, okay.
Two airplanes and five buildings. So that doesn't add up.
Yeah, it's like...
The whole thing was a staged...
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to use the kind of language that it really deserves, but...
Sure. No, I think people can understand the math.
Yeah.
So if you have two airplanes that collapse five buildings, that's rather difficult. It's kind of like during the Kennedy assassination, where you have one magic bullet shooting in and out of President Kennedy and Governor Colony of Texas like three or four times, five times, one bullet. Uh-huh, sure. So anyway, the math doesn't add up.
They're trained bullets that can stop and...
That's right. They're very intelligent bullets that can fly around on will and hitting different targets, go in and out all the time. That's something I didn't even know about, but I learned something new.
we mustn't joke about such an important thing.
I know.
But it's part of the tragedy that's been playing out over the decades, and it's not finished yet. Our responsibility is to remind people of what has been going on.
Sure.
That the shadow government, as it's called, or the cabal, or the military industrial intelligence complex, is keeping the truth from the people on everything of significance.
Right.
They're not telling them what they're doing. They're not telling the Congress what they're doing with their money. And they're not letting them in on the secret of what the game is and so on. And somehow that has to be reversed. It has to be reversed very quickly before it's too late. So that was really the reason for that that book. It's the third in the trilogy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
My first one was The Light at the End of the Tunnel, The Survival Plan for the Human Species, and I thought that was going to be my final book.
Mm-hmm.
It had some good suggestions in it, and it was the first one in which I mentioned the UFOs and ET presence and technology.
Sure.
And I thought that would be the end. Well, then so much new information came to me in the next two or three years that I decided I had to write the follow-up book, really, The Money Mafia of World in Crisis.
Right.
Which is probably the best book explaining what has happened and what the situation really is. Well, then the third book was also unexpected, but it was when I really realized that the military-industrial intelligence complex, a.k.a. cabal and so on, had reached the point where they could soon pull the wool over the eyes of the whole Western world and even more.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
And to start establishing their new world order. But I decided, hey, some of this information has to go out right away.
Right, right.
It was only about pamphlet size, which is the reason I took advice from an old friend, colleague in the House of Commons, who said, you've got to write your memoirs before you die.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I put in 15 chapters of my early days and struggles through politics.
Sure.
And then put the most important and things at the end about where we are now. And it's still memoirs because I'm still learning.
Sure.
And I've learned more in the last 13 years than I learned in the previous lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very bright lady the other day who read the two books, The Money Mafia and the current one, Oprah Stewart, and said, you know, all of the research you've done and the reading you've done for those two books is comparable to about four PhDs.
Wow, amazing, amazing, amazing.
So it was a lot of work.
Sure.
But it had to be done, and I've done my bit, but now I have to get the word out and try and get the books in the hands of the people.
Right.
because mostly what they hear on radio and TV and so on and newspapers is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to read books to really get it, to absorb the magnitude of the problem and how it developed and where it's leading and what has to be done about it.
Sure, sure.
So this is a good opportunity, Christmas coming up, for people to buy some books and give them to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And my books, all three of them, are available not only from your friendly book store, mm-hmm. but also from Amazon. And anyone who wants an autographed copy to give to someone or for themselves can get one from my website, which is Paul Hellyer, that's Paul, H-E-L-L-Y-E-R, .web, paulhellyerweb.com. And then they'll get an autographed copy that they can give to somebody who
wonderful.
Seems to have everything else.
Wonderful.
They're looking for a gift.
Wonderful. I wanted to share this with you, and I know you know about this, but I wanted to share. I think it's appropriate to mention this. President Eisenhower, in his farewell address on January 17, 1961, he said that we had to be careful of a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions, and I know you echo that in your work too. One of the things that he did, of course, he went into this agreement with the tyrannical negative reptilians back in March of 1954 that in exchange for some of their technology to fight the Soviets at the time, that they would be allowed to they would be allowed to abduct and study humans. Well, since that time, of course, the reptilians have abducted 6 million people off the planet, according to my galactic friends.
Well, he was black. He was blackmailed, wasn't he? Because didn't they tell him that if he didn't go along, that they would give the information to the Soviets?
That's right. That's right.
And they gave it to them anyway.
He gave it to the Soviets anyway. So they were playing both sides of the aisle. But yeah. Then, if we go forward from March of 54 to, was it the fall or summer of 59? Eisenhower tried to send a representative from the White House into Area 51 north of Las Vegas, where they were doing this technology transfer with the reptilians, and the CIA refused to let his representative in. Only after, and I think you wrote about this in your book, only after he had threatened the 6th Army from Denver to come over and forcibly take over the base, a U.S. installation. He threatened the use of U.S. military on a U.S. installation because it had been taken over by these reptilians. Did they allow him in? And they let his representative in. That was 1959. That was the last time, as far as I know, like 70 years ago or so, that anyone from the U.S., from the president's office, has gone into Area 51. All been
right.
Not
and I think it was very, I think, Eisenhower wished he had done otherwise, and
yeah.
He was trying to give us a message, but he didn't make it strong enough.
Right.
He didn't say that that it was as serious as it was that the ET information had fallen into the wrong hands.
Right.
And some of those wrong hands, as you know,
mm-hmm.
were Nazis that had been brought in under Operation Paperclip.
That's right.
And they were, I think, the ones who were primarily responsible for moving it to Nevada,
mm-hmm.
and working on it, because they had been working, I think, with some of the, I think they had been working with some of the extraterrestrials during World War II.
That's right. They were.
They just carried it over.
They just carried it over. That's all they did. You know why? You know why the reptilians chose Area 51 in Nevada? And they have another base called Dulce at the full four corners of Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado.
I thought the Dulce base was gray.
A gray slash reptilian.
Gray slash reptilian.
Yeah, yeah. The average temperature on the home planet of Draco, where the reptilians are from, is about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And they love desert areas. If you've ever seen a snake out in the desert or a lizard, they always get active when the sun comes out and it gets warm.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be much more inclined to have a reptilian base there than they would up in the Yukon because they like hot, dry areas. That's just the way they are. Their physiology is that way. So they love it down at Area 51. They love it at Dulce. Wherever it's hot and dry, that's the kind of climate they like because they get active from it.
Well, maybe that's the reason that they're not allowing us to save our planet for our use by doing something about global warming before it's too late.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's got to be done, and the technology exists, as you know.
Right.
Zero-point energy was developed by the U.S. in cooperation with one of the species way back in the 60s, and Dr. Michael Wolf, a radio broadcast 18 years ago, said that both cold fusion and zero-point energy had been developed.
Right.
And if we had put that into effect sooner, there'd be no problem today.
Right.
And if we start putting it into effect now, we won't have the absolute total disaster that there's going to be if we don't.
Right. Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more, Paul.
Absolutely. Well, we've got to get that information out.
And right.
My suggestion, which you probably have read, is that we do the exact opposite to what we did in World War II. We took all of the automobile plants and the refrigerator plants and washing machine plants and converted them into armaments plants.
Right.
Now we just do the opposite and take all of the armaments plants and convert them into plants to make zero-point energy boxes, engines, to put in our cars and trucks and tractors and airplanes and homes.
Right.
And save the planet from the absolute total disaster which is going to happen otherwise. And it's going to cost the United States trillions of dollars.
Right.
On the storms and so on that happen.
Right.
Within just a few years.
Right.
It's beginning to happen.
Right.
If something isn't done soon.
Right. I agree with you, Paul. I agree with you. People have to wake up, and one of the best things they can do if they're listening to CNN is simply turn off the television. Don't watch ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, or any of the alphabet soup network. They just don't have news. They're propaganda. And they cooperate with the cabal in making sure that the American public gets just the information to sway public opinion. Well,
we're doing our best to inform them.
That's right. Absolutely. 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 One thing you said, we've got about 2 minutes left, Paul. You said that in your book, toward the end of your book, a potential miracle can only happen from the ground up. And I always like to say on my program that what President Kennedy's told me, that he tried to institute changes from the top down back during his presidency before he was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, 55 years ago. But since that time, he's told me, too, that it's the destiny of this planet to ascend into the higher dimensions. And that's a comforting thought, because the changes now happening from this planet are coming from all of us, from all of my listeners today and good people around the world working from the bottom up to create a better planet.
That's true, and it's the only hope. And millions of people have to change from leaning toward the dark to leaning towards the light.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
A massive spiritual revolution that we
need,
and the action that follows it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Real quick, you go into the history of the space program, and one thing interesting you wrote: Ground Space Command, until the question who will represent Earth, the quote Nazi-controlled U.S. space fleet should sit on the ground until all crews have been screened for allegiance to the U.S. Constitution, the people of America. And
yes, I believe that.
Couldn't agree with you more, my friend. And Paul, we just got a couple of seconds left. I want to thank you so much for coming on today, and I hope you can come to my conference next year, the Galactic Wisdom Conference.
Well, I'm giving it some thought, and I'll let you know.
Okay. All right, Paul. Well, thank you again so much for your wonderful work, Paul, and on behalf of all my listeners worldwide, thank you so much for your wonderful work in making this planet a better place.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. That was Paul Hellier coming to us live from Toronto, Canada. I hope everyone has a wonderful and really happy weekend. And thank you again so much for listening today. Take care, friends. Bye-bye.
なたに光